Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. North Atlantic right whales are approaching extinction with fewer than 350 remaining. They are one of the world's most endangered whale species. North Atlantic right whales have been listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act since 1970. Today's guest, marine biologist and veterinarian Dr. Michael Moore, wrote the book, We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility, to convince us that the welfare of North Atlantic right whales and the very survival of the species is in our hands. He says we've reached a tipping point. Quote, few humans eat whale meat anymore, but fishing techniques unintentionally harm and kill whales. Even vegetarians contribute to the problem, as we all benefit from global shipping of consumer goods and fuel, which in its current iteration leads to fatal collisions with whales. Entanglement in fishing gear can sentence these animals to months of pain and a slow death. It doesn't have to be this way. We have the technology and the collaborations that are necessary to change the right whale's future, but citizens have to use their wallets to make it happen. Hopefully, politicians still listen to their electorate, end quote. So what can we do to save these majestic creatures? What is our responsibility? And what about the politics and the economics behind this? The Biden administration recently rejected an emergency petition aimed at protecting right whales from lethal ship strikes. Joining us to talk about all of this is Dr. Michael Moore, a world-renowned marine biologist, veterinarian, and director of the Marine Mammal Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the world's leading independent nonprofit dedicated to ocean research, exploration, and education. Dr. Moore has been with the institution since 1986. He's devoted his life to developing methods for saving wild whales in distress, especially critically endangered North Atlantic right whales. Hi, Dr. Moore. Thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, first off, can you tell us how right whales are tracked? How do we know that there were 480 alive in 2010, and now there are, what, just about, is it 340? Is that the official number?
Yeah, that's a good number. These numbers are all modeled, so they're not absolute counts, but certainly it's a reasonable perspective on where we were at a few years ago and where we are now. And so how are they tracked? Everybody says, well, why don't you just tag them all? Then we'll know where they are and satellite will beep up and we'll see a nice screen. But it isn't that simple, because these tags have a finite life that maybe a few months, maybe a year if you're lucky. They require you to go revisit the animal every time the tag fails. After it's failed, then you've got to find it again. And also, there's some significant trauma that these tags relate, because to make the tag stick, you've got to penetrate through the blubber and into the muscle, and the muscle and the blubber slide across each other every time the animal swims. And so essentially you're carving a hole in the back of the animal every time you tag it, or every time it swims with the tag on. So there are other technologies in development, such as using satellites to count the whales. And that's very much in its infancy. The algorithms to really recognize a whale's image, especially to speciate it, is still very limited. So the primary tool we use is for counting the animals, surveys, whether it be visual from a boat or from a plane, or acoustic listening with buoys and drifters and gliders and all kinds of things. But if you want to actually know whether that animal is something, an animal you caught you counted yesterday, you have to recognize it as an individual or the previous year. And so fortunately, right whales have a very prominent individual marking system, essentially, largely based upon a sort of nose print, if you like. They have these individually identifiable unique patterns on their heads. It's thickened leathery skin, which is populated by some whale lice. We call them cyamids. And so each whale has its own individual head fingerprint, if you like. But also, unfortunately, they acquire through life, the vast majority of them, scars and other markings related to the trauma that we inflict upon them, such as entanglement in rope, and also other cuts from vessels, propellers, and so on. So what's happened is that a large consortium of scientists and conservationists and members of the general public have contributed photographs of these animals since, really goes back to about 1930, to build a catalogue of individuals. And that's maintained by the Newland Aquarium, an organization called the Right Whale, North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. And so all of those photographs get matched by folks that can recognize the individuals, and each individual has its own catalog page with the sort of poster child image of each animal. And so we can say with good certainty that this animal was seen here in this condition. Maybe it was pregnant, maybe it had a calf, maybe it was entangled. So all of those different life history pieces come along with it. And the modelers can then take all of those observations and do a very good job of actually saying, okay, in 2020 we had X animals, in 2022 we had Y, and break down the species into reproductively active females, reproductively inactive females, so the adults that never actually calve, of which there's a significant number. And we can also recognize how frequently they calve. They should, if the population was healthy, calve every 3 years. But sometimes they don't calve for more than 10 because they can't get enough food, or there's too much stress from being entangled and they're dragging rope around, so the energy goes into swimming hard rather than building babies. Mm. So essentially, it's the catalog number is based upon individually identifiable records of animals up and down the East Coast from Florida primarily up to Newfoundland in Canada.
So if there are 340 remaining, only 70 can reproduce. Is that right?
Right. So that's not all of the adult females, but of the adult females, those are the ones that have been known to be reproducing once they've reached an age and a length that is compatible with getting pregnant and raising a calf. So it's been changing too. We've been using small drones and airplanes too in previous decades to measure these animals. If you take a flat photograph at a known altitude, you can count the pixels in the image and then figure out how long the animal was at a particular age. And so with accumulated data from the catalog, along with the length measurements, we've been able to show that right whales have been growing to an adult length that's modeled to be about a meter or a yard less than it was, say, 25, 30 years ago. So animals born in the 80s got longer than the ones they do now. And we're showing that results in a reduced capacity to get pregnant and successfully raise calves because they don't have the resources. It's kind of not like not having a big enough gas tank. So a bigger semi-truck can go further with a bigger tank, whereas a smaller pickup truck is going to struggle to go the same distance and be productive in the process. So it's very disturbing and disappointing that we're not seeing the growth in this highly endangered species.
Mm. Before we dive in and just talk about all of the crises that we're dealing with right now and what we can do to save these whales, can you just spend a few minutes talking to us about these incredible creatures? In your book, you write, "Words often fail when I try to express the awe and wonder that these animals elicit."
Yeah, well, we are very fortunate to see right whales every year close to my home in Massachusetts. There's an area created by the east coast of Massachusetts that runs down towards the arm of Cape Cod that then circles back around up to Provincetown. It's called Cape Cod Bay. And it's been known that it's an important area for right whales, really, for science at least, since the 1950s. In recent years, it's become particularly prominent for the species as more and more of them come to that area in January through May. And so we use small drones to measure their length and width routinely, and have been doing that for about 6-7 years now. And so whenever the weather's good, and it's not good very often this time of year in New England, but when it is, we are able to fly these drones from a boat, and they can't hear the drone, and we're up about 140 feet or something like that. But it's an incredible perspective on what they're doing, especially when they're feeding near or at the surface, because they're kind of like the size of a school bus and the shape of a school bus in some ways, with a couple of flippers and a tail on the back. And then their heads have this upper jaw that is very narrow. And on the upper jaw, there are these marks, as I've described, the callosities, the thickened skin. And you can see that that allows you to comb in on the animals quite well, especially from the air. And then hanging down from that are these horny, keratinized, just like fingernails, really, fronds of baleen, which is what the whalers used to prize for making things that today we make out of plastic, because it's flexible and very strong. And that's the filtration apparatus. So they have a couple of hundred baleen plates either side hanging down. On the inside face of those plates are these hairy bristles that mat together to create a filter bed. So as they go through the water, they are skim feeding, we call it. So it's kind of like towing a bucket through the water to get samples of plankton. And they're feeding on plankton. So they're like a plankton net, really. And so the big, wide, muscular tail is pushing the animal along, and you can see the tail pumping up and down. And as they're going through the water, their mouth is wide open, so they're creating a lot of drag, and they've got the mouth open with this big orifice at the front. It's like a big gaping hole. And for some reason, and I never understand why, it very often shines like a flashlight. You can see the light reflecting off the lower jaw and the tongue as they're pushing through the water. And they're very, very good at sensing where the thickest bands of plankton are. So they'll go through the water at the appropriate height, and you can see them actually adjusting their head height as the bands sort of wave up and down. And when they get to the edge of this patch of plankton, they'll do a U-ey, just like you do when you're mowing the lawn with the lawnmower. And they'll come back through until they've basically vacuumed up the entire package of plankton in that area. So these skim feeding right whales are extraordinary from a boat, but incredible from the air, because you get to see a lot more through the upper part of the water column to get a sense of what they're doing. So they can sometimes skim feed for 10 minutes or so, and they may just cock their head up a little bit to breathe and then carry on. And sometimes they do it in parallel with each other, and sometimes they run into each other and just miss each other. So it's a glorious mess as they move around, and we just stop the boat, and they do their thing, and we watch them passively. And it's a very special experience, especially end of the day. They often come up close to the surface because that's where the plankton are, and you'll get the low golden light coming off the cliffs, and oh, it's like it's the seventh wonder of the world. It's kind of like a sort of northern subpolar Serengeti. It's just, they're so wild and so different, and it's ugly but beautiful. They're wonderful animals.
That's a great way to describe them. And as you write in your book, females first calve at 9 to 10 years of age if they manage to get pregnant.
Right. And so where they calve is down in Florida and Georgia primarily. It used to be 1,000 years ago, there were another whole population of North Atlantic right whales on the east coast of the North Atlantic. And so they would calve down off of the Western Sahara in Africa. But we don't think there are many left at all that do that now. But so the ones that are left, if they're pregnant and ready to calve, they'll head down the eastern seaboard and arrive December, January, or even February in the Georgia, Florida area on the east coast there. And they'll calve, and the moms will support the calves until They can swim on their own, and they suckle. And by mid-April, we start to see the moms bringing their calves north, and we'll run into them in Cape Cod Bay, and they'll be around for 3 or 4 weeks before they move on east of east and south of Nantucket, and then through the summer they'll increasingly go to Canada. There used to be that a lot of them would go to the Bay of Fundy, which is that indentation between Nova Scotia and eastern Maine, but the water has been warming in the Gulf of Maine such that there's a much better feed for them now in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So through the summer and early fall, you'll see them up there as well. And they'll take their calves there, and they'll stay with them for between 6 and 12 months, depending upon how things go.
Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Michael Moore, a world-renowned marine biologist, director of the Marine Mammal Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and author of We're All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Dr. Moore said he wrote this book to convince us that the welfare of North Atlantic right whales and the very survival of the species is in our hands. If you have any questions for Dr. Moore about whales, specifically the North Atlantic right whale, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org, and you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Michael, can you tell us just how you got involved in this work and why you're dedicating your life to this? As you write in your book, you grew up in England, you were trained as a vet, and you were shown the enormous wealth of a productive marine ecosystem off of eastern Newfoundland, but also the harsh reality of the trauma that whales face when they're in conflict with humans harvesting a mutual food resource. So tell us a little bit more about how you got to this place.
Sure. So as an undergraduate, I was volunteering on a boat in eastern Canada in Newfoundland, and it was a small, leaky boat, but we had a good time. And really, it was humpback whales that we were studying there, and we were looking at the ecology of the animals and how they made a living. They were feeding on bait fish, capelin, which were also the prey for codfish, and the Newfoundlanders would set cod traps. And so the traps were set where the capelin and hence the cod were thickest. But the trouble was that the humpback whales were also feeding on the capelin. So the humpbacks would get trapped in these big rooms of net, if you like. They were big, wide boxes in the water column and anchored. And so when the whales blundered into these nets, they would quite often be anchored there, and hopefully they could breathe and they would need to be released. And colleague John Lean developed a lot of techniques to help the fishermen get the whales out of their nets, to get the gear back and the whale free. So that was one experience I had back in 79 and later years. And then just as I finished vet school, I spent some time working for the International Whaling Commission as a observer on a whaling ship in west of Iceland. And they wanted to know how humane the harpoons were, and sort of somewhat daunting prospect to actually get involved in that side of things. But what was striking to me was that the speed with which this harpoon technology actually killed these animals, that they were either instantly dead or some minutes. And that was a data point that I parked in my head, and I came over to the U.S. and worked as a veterinarian for a while, and then became a scientist in Woods Hole. And I came back to that observation when I started to do the math in the context of the right whale catalog that I mentioned earlier, looking at how long these entangled right whales that were being killed by chronic entanglement were alive before they died. And I was shocked, and it began to put the perspective that I'd started in Newfoundland and Iceland into another whole timeline. It took seconds or minutes to kill with a harpoon. And yet when you're killing a whale with rope unintentionally, it could take 6 months. The average time to death from first entanglement, of a lethal entanglement for a right whale, is 6 months. Mm. And so that made me really sit back and say, okay, we've all been very vocal about not killing whales with harpoons, and I concur totally. But through the seafood consumer demand for codfish or lobster, because much of the current entanglements for right whales is in lobster gear or snow crab gear, so lobster and snow crab demand, those fishermen would not be fishing if consumers were not enabling the market. And that's where I look to myself and others to recognize that our consumer demand is really the root of the trauma that is resultant in these animals getting caught in fishing gear. Or, and this is the other way that right whales and other large whales die today, getting hit by ships and smaller vessels. And vessel strikes are the second big problem with large whale mortality and sublethal trauma today. So again, those ships wouldn't be running in the North Pacific or the North Atlantic between supply and consumption destinations if the consumers weren't demanding it. And so there's two different levels of approach to how we consider the problem of trauma in large whales today. We can legislate to reduce those factors, and the legislation that's in play today is the Endangered Species Act of 1972 and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the same era. And we do that ad nauseam. Today, 50 years later, we're still struggling to, in the case of these large whale species, especially the North Atlantic right whale, to actually do what the Endangered Species Act required within, I think, 12 months, 50 years ago, which is thou shalt not kill right whales because there are too few to be able to afford to do that. So whilst I wouldn't belittle any of the legislative regulatory management effort that has been made to enable this species to thrive, it's not enough, because the political and economic counterweight to the ethic that we need to avoid making large whale species go extinct is the need for human success and economic survival. And so in the East Coast today, because many of the mandates of the conservation regulations fly in the face of perceived inability to have an economically viable trap fishing industry or a maritime delivery industry, then the compromises kick in, and the measures that make a lot of sense from a scientific and a conservation point of view are challenged because of their economic and political cost. And so the only way that that balance can shift, in my mind, is for the consumer to say, I do care about the survival of this species or these other large whales, and I am willing to demand and pay for the ethical solutions to these sources of trauma. And for vessels, that means that they go slower. 10 knots is a good compromise number. And that means that the delivery of container ships from overseas will be slower, and therefore the cost of transport will increase. And in the same way, there are ways to catch shellfish, such as lobster and crab, that don't involve having rope in the water column. We have in development technologies that would use acoustic triggers to retrieve the traps from the bottom. And all of that is conceivable and doable with adequate investment and with adequate motivation. And I'm not saying that we should boycott seafood, because that isn't a solution. We want seafood. We need it. It's nutrition, and it's an industry that for certain communities, such as in the coast of Maine, are critical to the survival of the human communities. But there is compromise where such that humans could, and consumers can demand that those industries do their business in such a way that the whales can survive and prosper. And I don't believe that that's impossible. But until the political driving force of the voter to demand that they, these issues become important enough that the regulations are enforced and the opportunities to fish ethically and move maritime goods and recreational vessels at speeds that are appropriate, then we're not going to succeed. And so we're in that battle right now. And certainly if you, certainly on the East Coast with the North Atlantic right whale challenges, the, in the last 2 or 3 months, the chapter and verse of the diverse ways in which this challenge is playing out is very complicated. And laws are being passed to override other laws in a way that, you know, the omnibus spending bill in December included freezing conservation measures for 4 years for North Atlantic right whales. And, you know, that has been a cause for great celebration on the coast of Maine and beating of chests of conservationists across the country. And so there has to be a way in the middle that both these industries, the stakeholders, but also the whales can sustainably live together. And I believe that's possible, but the expectation and the demand for this has to be driven by the consumer.
We are going to take a quick break. After a break, we'll ask Dr. Moore to elaborate on the solutions that he just laid out. And we'll talk more about the Biden administration's decision to reject an emergency petition aimed at protecting right whales from lethal ship strikes. And as Dr. Moore just stated, this actually follows a Senate rider that delays lobster entanglement protections. Today, we are joined by Dr. Michael Moore, a world-renowned marine biologist, director of the Marine Mammal Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and author of We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss how the mass shootings in Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay, California, have led to even more anxiety and trauma within the AAPI community. Since COVID began, there's been over 11,000 reported hate incidents against the Asian community. So what is being done to address this collective trauma and end the violence? On Wednesday and Thursday, we will discuss the brutal police killing of Tyre Nichols. We will not be playing any audio from the brutal killing. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Michael Moore, author of We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Dr. Moore is a world-renowned marine biologist and director of the Marine Mammal Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Today, we are talking about what it will take to save the North Atlantic right whale. They have been listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act since 1970. There are 340 remaining and 70 can reproduce. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Michael Moore, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Before we talk more about solutions, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Peter in Florida. Hi, Peter. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thank you. I'm learning so much about whales. And, it's a question, because this occurred to me as I'm listening. Woods Hole, I'm a member, I contribute to them. Acoustic pollution, aside from the ship strikes, simply the vibration of the ship going through, I understand, throws off their ability to locate food and to locate mates. And we're learning so much. I know, and that's also an issue with these windmills in the ocean. Are they making vibrations in the water that is throwing off, you know, the right whale's acoustic orientation to the world around them? Do you have any insights about that?
Well, first disclaimer, I am not an acoustician. And so what I'll say is with that prefix, you're absolutely right that noise in the ocean is a very significant environmental parameter. There are sources of noise that are natural and also from humans. So earthquakes, wind, weather, seas are all naturally there. But my colleague Susan Parks, for instance, she's at University of Syracuse, published a paper some time ago where she looked at the frequency of the calls of right whales, both in the northern and southern hemisphere. There are another species down in the southern hemisphere. And she was looking at how the frequency changed through time. And her conclusion was that as the oceans got noisier from man-made noise, such as the noise from engines and vibrations from ships, they actually changed the frequency, the tone of their communications. They ramped it up a little bit so that it's kind of like the cocktail party syndrome where you speak louder and more shrilly to try and get yourself heard above the background noise. And so what that means in terms of sublethal and possibly lethal impacts on these animals is harder to say because it's a very difficult measurement to make. And I think it's unlikely that, we haven't any reasonable evidence for large whales suffering lethal trauma, with the exception of some cases of explosions in humpback whales a long time ago. But most of the impacts are presumably sublethal and behavioral. And I say this in terms of large whales because there is also better evidence for the impact of, say, defense sonar systems on the behavior of toothed whales, such as beaked whales and dolphins occasionally, but particularly the beaked whales. So they can actually have a behavioral change where they may strand and get into trouble with their ability to manage decompression issues, diving physiology challenges. So the answer to the acoustic question is complex and species specific and very contextually specific too. And recently the press has been pushing the questions by some conservationists and others in terms of what the effects of ocean noise associated with exploration for offshore wind development may have to do with the recent uptick in strandings on the coast of New Jersey of humpback whales. And honestly, we have no good evidence that that is the cause of this mortality. Obviously, it's important to ask the question. But in many ways, the whole noise thing is a lot more nebulous. It's harder to wrap your head around as opposed to when you have a dead whale on a beach that has been hit by a vessel and you can see that it's been sliced up like a loaf of bread by a spinning propeller. Mm. So that is a much more tangible cause of death. And so the impacts of noise are more nebulous, probably less lethal, more sublethal behavioral change, some level of stress. I mean, there was a study done by some colleagues where they were at sea during the 9/11 event and shipping stopped for a number of days. And what they noticed was that the level of steroid hormones, of stress hormones that they were measuring in the feces of these animals dipped strikingly over 9/11, 9/12, 9/13. And then it came back up again. So there is definitely some pretty good evidence for a physiological functional effect of noise on these animals, but what the longer term consequences of that in terms of feeding success, reproductive success, and so on, is a much harder answer to give than to say that yes, there is some impact, but we don't really understand the long term impacts.
Thank you so much for the call, Peter. We should do another show about the issues that you raised. We'll definitely add that to our list. Thanks for the call. One more question from a guest before we get into solutions. Gordon writes, can you please comment on the impact of cruise ships in particular? I assume that there are instances of whale strikes killing or grievously injuring whales. I've addressed this question to the captain of a large cruise ship while on board a few years ago, and he dismissed the issue entirely, claiming that the whales hear the ships coming and get out of the way. Is there science and data that can answer this question?
Well, I can certainly say that there's nothing unique about a cruise ship. They are varying sizes of large vessel that make noises and go quite fast. And so the faster the vessel, the harder it is for the animals to evade them. But I don't think there's anything specifically bad or good about a cruise ship as opposed to a cargo ship or a Navy ship or an exploration research vessel. They're all large steel structures moving through the water at various speeds with propulsion noises and spinning propellers. And so it's kind of like the risk of trauma in a road. You've got large trucks and you've got smaller vessels and you've got motorcycles. And they all have their own little niche in terms of how they're going to traumatize humans to varying levels of lethality. But the concern is more the aggregate rather than the specific. We're all adding, by driving our cars at various speeds, we're adding various levels of risk to pedestrians and other motorists. And so I don't see the cruise ship industry as being particularly good or particularly bad, but they are large, fast ships, and they're on a mission to get from A to B. So yes, they are significant. It's just the same with the offshore wind industry. I think the offshore wind industry has maintenance and crew movements and exploration systems, all of which are dependent upon vessel traffic. So it's an incremental addition to the vessel strike risk for large whales in general. But it's not necessarily something bad unto itself. It's simply our demands for, in this case, renewable energy is leading to an increased vessel strike risk. And so, yes, if there were no cruise ships, then there will be less of a vessel strike risk. But there's nothing specifically good or bad about them.
Well, thank you for that question, Gordon. We also have been wanting to do shows about the cruise ship industry. So thank you for the question. Michael, before we talk about solutions, you know, given that you have been doing this important work for decades, can you tell us how demand for lobster and crab has changed and what concerns you the most? I mean, I was just searching lobster shipping, and there's a website that says you can get fresh Maine lobster shipped overnight to your door. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you did not see 10 years ago, for example. So can you just tell us how this industry has changed, especially how demand has increased for lobster and crab?
I'm really not the person to talk to that because, you know, I'm not a fisheries biologist. I'm a whale trauma biologist. But I think really when it comes to trying to identify the risk to large whales for trauma, it's really a question of coexistence in time and space. So if you're setting lobster traps in an area where whales never go, then that's a very low risk. But if you're setting them where whales are all the time, such as in the springtime in Cape Cod Bay, as I've said, then that's not good. So the sort of coexistence in time and space to really assess the risk is important. And, you know, certainly I think the capacity, as you've said, to deliver fresh seafood globally has increased significantly as the ability to affreight material and people around the world has increased substantially. And so to that extent, the market, there's a large market for fresh lobster in China, for instance, coming from New England. And that all, the actual air travel of that doesn't worry the whales at all, but it does increase the economic value of the industry that is setting rope in the water column. And that's the factor that matters. And so, you know, the main lobster industry has grown substantially, both in catch and value. It was worth, I think, $750 million a couple of years ago, not quite so much in the last year. So it is a very significant piece of the financial stability of that part of the state. Not the biggest by any means, but it is significant.
I was just reading from News 4 Jax in Cumberland Island, Georgia. This piece just came out 3 days ago. A 15-year-old right whale named Nimbus is now free from being entangled in a fishing rope. Nimbus was spotted by a Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission whale survey aircraft entangled 13 miles east of Jekyll Island. Trained responders working from boats used special tools to remove 375 feet of 11 by 16 inch diameter synthetic rope that was passing through the whale's mouth. So this is just happening just a couple of days ago. This is the whale that we know about. So if the majority of right whale deaths can be attributed to entanglement, can you describe first how this process works and then solutions? There's a really good video at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution of a boat, a lobster boat, dropping a lobster trap. So it basically looks like a, I don't know how big the box is, but it's a box that is dropped into the ocean by a rope. So first, can you just tell us how that process works and then solutions to ensure that whales do not get entangled in that dropped rope?
Sure. Well, you covered a lot of ground in that run up there. So let's answer your first question, but I want to get back to the disentanglement story you told as well. So basically, traditionally, the way that lobsters have been harvested is that you build a lobster trap, which is a wire mesh today. It used to be made out of wood, but now it's a wire mesh covered in plastic with an opening lid at the top and different sections within it so that you can hang bait in there, and there's a funnel where the lobsters come in and they find the bait and they can't get back out. Although they can, but they take a while and they get caught and hold before they do. So essentially the trap or traps in a line in the deeper water are thrown over the side, and each trap, if it's just one trap at a time or the string of traps, has a line attached to one end or to each trap that will be used to pull it back up when it's ready to be harvested. And the top end of that line has a buoy or a flag with a pole on it so that the owner of the trap can come back after a certain amount of time, days or more, to pull it back up and take out the harvestable catch, refresh the bait and put it back over the side. So what that does, and that's true for crabs too, so what that does is it leaves a forest of rope in the water column running from the end of the trawls, the long line of traps or the individual traps, and the rope goes up to the surface. And so if the right whale is swimming along, minding its own business, feeding on copepods as they do, they can brush into this rope. And in the process, they can wrap the rope around the flipper or around the upper part of the head or the tail or all three body parts. Then they panic and they spin and they get further wraps. And sometimes they can swim off with the gear. Sometimes the gear gets caught on the bottom and then they break the line. And as they swim, very often the rope gets tighter and tighter and starts to constrict in and destroy the animal through compression, essentially. So that's the normal way. And so if the rope in the water column can be got rid of, then the risk of entanglement is very substantially reduced. And what we've been working with in recent years is a very old technology that was around since the 60s, whereby you can retrieve equipment from the bottom of the ocean by using an acoustic sound pulse as a trigger. So the end cage of a string of traps isn't actually fishing. It's got some technology in it where either it's got an inflatable bag or it's got a coil of rope that's in the cage. And when you hit the acoustic button, it receives that signal and the cage pops open and the rope floats to the surface so you can retrieve it, or the bag inflates and the cage comes up. And then you can retrieve the trap or traps without having to have had water rope in the water column for the whole period of the duration of the setting of the traps. So we call this on-demand or ropeless fishing, and it's controversial. It's been developed on both the West Coast with Dungeness crabs and also on the East Coast with American lobster and snow crab in Canada. And we've got to the point now where in the spring of 2022, some snow crab fishermen in the Gulf of St. Lawrence were able to harvest over 1 million pounds of snow crab in an area that was closed to fishing with lines from the bottom to the surface using on-demand gear, and they sold that. Likewise, now in the U.S., there are areas that are closed to fishing with end lines, and there are now experimental permits in process where people are fishing today using this on-demand gear as well. So, you know, it's early days. One of the biggest challenges of this on-demand gear is that you've taken away the marker, the signpost at the surface, which is, shows other people where the gear is on the bottom. So if I wanted to set gear, I know that my buddy here has got gear on the right, I'll go to the left. But if his gear is not marked on the surface with a flag, then it's cryptic. You can't see it. However, that same acoustic system on the bottom can also enable a virtual flag on a screen on the boat to enable other fishermen, other mobile gear fishermen, draggers and scallopers to know where the gear is, even though they can't see it visually, they can see it virtually, like a pin drop on a Google Maps thing, same thing. And so this is something that has some challenges to it. There's cost, there's safety issues, all of which are being worked on. And so the solution to the entanglement problem is a significant part is to reduce the amount of entanglement risk by taking the rope out of the water column.
So that's what makes it controversial. Dr. Marr, we don't have that much time left, but I just want to ask you a couple questions about the politics behind this and then what people can do. This got quite a bit of attention in December. Senator Chuck Schumer and Patrick Leahy inserted a right whale policy rider into a funding budget, which gives the lobster fishery 6 years to delay actions to prevent fishing gear from entangling and killing critically endangered North Atlantic right whales. I mean, this is really becoming, it has been a major issue for many, many years, of course, but now restaurants are pulling lobster from their menu, and Seafood Watch took really an unprecedented step recently, classifying American lobster as seafood to avoid. So there's just so much happening right now. First off, what are your thoughts about this rider that was inserted into the funding budget?
Well, essentially, it denies process in as much as the careful way in which the regulatory tools that were created by the Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, are essentially sidestepped by a rider that says, this is not up for the debate. It's buried in a very large funding bill. This is the way it's going to be. So essentially, the one law was cut out simply by a non-negotiable rider. And so there are precedents for this in the past, and I think it's really denying due process, and that's too bad.
In our remaining minutes, we're going to have you back because we need 2 hours really to talk about this. I mean, you are working with engineers, scientists, and fishermen to test this gear. What are you hearing from fishermen about where we are right now, given that you've got Seafood Watch, for example, their program out of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, basically saying that you should avoid lobster? I mean, what are you hearing from fishermen?
Well, I'm hearing from fishermen very different things depending upon where they sit. And I think it's important to acknowledge that the omnibus bill that we were talking about also has a very strong language in terms of funding to accelerate the development of this new technology. And so the fishermen that have seen the writing on the wall have been working very hard to make it all work, and they're out doing it right now. And so those guys who were shut out, the carrot and stick was such that they they saw that their ability to get back into the fishery was dependent upon developing with the engineers and the scientists and the managers a viable on-demand systems, which is what has happened. Now, the folks that don't want to see that happen and they want to carry on fishing the way they want to fish, I understand that totally. And they have residual concerns of safety and cost and so on that are very real. And, you know, the goal is to meet in the middle such that the fishery can sustain itself and the whales can be sustainable. So that's, you know, we're somewhere in the middle, and there are fishermen who have become strong advocates for this gear, and there are many fishermen who are detractors for the gear. And so that's the challenge.
And we have about 30 seconds left. What about our responsibility? It's in the title of your book, We Are All Whalers, sure. The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility.
We need to communicate with our retailers and wholesalers and the system managers, from the state and the federal politicians all the way down through the system to the suppliers, to the supermarket chains. And there are many folks within all of those places that are sympathetic to how this can work. But essentially, the individuals need to demand and make this a significant issue as opposed to just a political football, which is currently the way it is.
Dr. Michael Moore is a world-renowned marine biologist, director of the Marine Mammal Center at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and author of the book, We Are All Whalers, The Plight of Whales and Our Responsibility. Dr. Moore, thank you so much for your important work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Well, I appreciate it, and thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can learn more about the plight of right whales and Dr. Moore's work at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.